Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. And as this year comes to a close, we're looking back on some of the stories that dominated the news in 2013. Today, we will focus on the leaks from the NSA contractor Edward Snowden that dripped out during 2013 and have shaken up the national security establishment, causing repercussions to our foreign policy abroad and blowback to American businesses around the world. We begin with a broadcast of Background Briefing from June 10, 2013, and look into the post-9/11 intelligence industrial complex following the latest leaks from an employee of an intelligence contractor, Booz Allen Hamilton, who in turn are owned by the Carlyle Group. A former CIA veteran, Robert Baer, joins us to discuss the real story that has been lost amid the familiar civil liberties versus national security arguments, and that is that the taxpayer is being swindled by multi-billion dollar boondoggles that don't work. Then, from August 13, 2013, we will speak with one of America's premier military experts who, along with the Washington Post's Dana Priest, wrote the groundbreaking expose of the privatized national security state, Top Secret America. William Arkin joins us to discuss his explosive follow-up, American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution. We discuss his new book that describes the desk-bound takeover of the highest reaches of government by a coterie of gray men of the national security establishment that he calls the executive agents. We look into how doomsday has become every day in contemporary America as a result of the forever war and how the mechanism is already in place for an American coup that William Arkin warns about in this latest and most powerful reminder of our fading freedoms that we are trading away for a fictional guarantee of security. Then finally, from December 9th, 2013, we'll look into the full-page ad from the giant tech companies in the New York Times and Washington Post calling on the President and Congress to rein in the NSA. Mark Rotenberg, the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, joins us to discuss the call for tighter controls on government surveillance in an open letter from AOL, Apple, Facebook, Google, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Twitter, and Yahoo, and the international blowback from NSA spying that is hurting American business. And joining us now is Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He is the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Great to be back.
And the story that's going on now with this Snowden, Edward J. Snowden, and Booz Allen, and the NSA leak, etc., which is consuming the press, but it seems to me it's basically the old familiar argument of civil liberties versus national security. And what most of the press are missing, I think, is the real story here, which is this enormous boondoggle that's going on with Booz Allen, for whom this young man, Edward Snowden, worked, and the extent to which they are a classic revolving door. And they, in turn, Booz Allen, are owned by the Carlyle Group, which is another classic revolving door. When you look at the fact that Booz Allen's revenues for the last fiscal year was $5.76 billion, and they're number 436 on the Fortune 500 list of largest public companies, 98% of their revenues come from you and me and the taxpayer. I mean, what's going on here?
Well, Ian, first of all, I take issue with your word choice. It's not a revolving door. It's a swindle. I had a young man working for me. He was what's called a reports officer. He simply edited reports from the field. And one day he comes to me and says, you know, I got a great offer with Booz Allen. He resigned from the CIA the next day with his top secret security clearance, which is in itself has a value, went to work for Booz Allen. He was promised training. He was promised, a way up the corporate ladder and so forth and so forth. He came back, worked for me again in exactly the same job with no training, with a little bit more salary, and Booz Allen made five times what he was making on his contract. It is just a great swindle. There is no other way to put it. When you consider this young man didn't have a high school education, didn't complete high school, goes to work for the federal government at $200,000 a year, you can count on Booz Allen making off that contract $1 million. Maybe more. I don't know. It's hard to tell. You lose sight of this. this whole contracting thing has taken billions upon billions of dollars, you know, hived it off the federal budget, goes where, we don't know. There's absolutely no internal controls, and it's just a great swindle for no value added.
Well, it's a perfect swindle in the sense that the people who are swindling the government are working for a secret government agency, the National Security Agency, and right across the street you have Booz Allen, and the NSA basically gives them the blank check, and they provide services which apparently the Congress is not exercising any kind of oversight over what they're buying. My understanding is this project that Snowden leaked, PRISM, is a vast boondoggle. It doesn't do a damn thing in terms of the war on terror.
Look, and there is no one has come forward and showed how PRISM saved American lives. I've seen allusions to the subway bomber, Zazi, and the rest of it. But if you look at the court documents, they all point toward British sources tracking a bomb maker. And right across the board, look, the point is that with PRISM and getting in the metadata, the telephone companies, this stuff is extremely useful after an event occurs, not before. The software does not work. You can't put in like a Google-like search saying, you know, where are the terrorists in the world, and it comes up with an answer. It doesn't work that way. I worked for the Special Tribunal for Lebanon. I watched how, after the assassination of the prime minister, they got into the data, the metadata, and figured out who the assassins were. But again, it was after the event, not before. And what we're doing is taking all this money and pretending that we can stop terrorism by, you know, a magic bullet. There is no magic bullet in this. It doesn't work. There is no algorithm that can predict the future and predict what people are going to do. It just, I can't talk about the future, but it doesn't work now, and it doesn't justify the billions upon billions of dollars. And we are being swindled, every penny of this. And you know, I stay on the phone all day with people in the intelligence agencies, people just retired and the rest of it. I'm on the phone with the SEALs. All the rest of them call it a swindle. These are active operators on the ground that do the hard work, that stop the terrorism, that went after bin Laden, and they call it a swindle. And they resent the contractors, and they resent people in Congress making money off of this. And like this young man, whether it doesn't matter whether he's right or wrong about the civil liberties, the point is, what was he doing in that job without a high school degree? It's nuts.
And you're saying that his salary was $200,000, but Booz Allen, because they sold his contract, they're making about $1 million out of him?
Absolutely. What happens is you go into the CIA, you get the CIA to pay for a security clearance, which costs a lot of money to do a background investigation, polygraphs. Once you have that top secret security clearance, then you go farm yourself out to one of these contractors like Booz Allen, who doesn't do anything to vet these people. All they care about is they have a top secret security clearance, hire them, you know, boost their salary to whatever. Well, in this case, it was a lot. This guy probably came in at $30,000 or $40,000. So they treble his salary at the very least, or quadruple it. But on top of that, they quadruple the fee, pretending they're doing something. It is
that's their value added. In other words, their value added to the U.S. government.
Their value added, their cost added.
Sure,
five times the contract.
Wow,
it can be less, can be more. I just don't know. You can't say. There's not a general rule.
But what you're telling us here, Robert Baer, is that not only are they the basis of the contracts, all of this, these so-called technical fixes to terrorism, these technological fixes involving software programs and algorithms, that's what they sell in terms of hardware, which doesn't work. But in terms of software, in terms of brain power, they're also poaching from the government. So they get it both ways. They make money out of people they poach out of the government, and they make enormous amounts of money out of the government selling stuff that we don't know what it is and whether it works. And when you've got people like John McConnell, who now works for Booz Allen, the former head of the NSA, obviously signing off on all of these deals, and then James Clapper, the current director of National Intelligence, who's a former Booz Allen director, there you have the revolving door, and the company itself is owned by the ultimate revolving door. Corps, which is the Carlyle Group, started by Frank Carlucci, President Reagan's National Security Advisor.
Ian, it's called feather bedding. It's been around since the beginning of man. The generals keep their mouths shut, keep these programs going, go to Congress, say they need them. They get their 4-star, and when they retire, they get a job. They get paid off. They go back, and they run these companies. They sit on the boards. They don't do anything. And the carousel just continues. And, you know, you look back at Boston, where, you know, if any time the algorithm should have been kicked in, is then. But they weren't, because it doesn't work. I mean, this guy's travel to Dagestan should have gone in the system, and it should have kicked in PRISM, or, you know, whatever else these programs are. And they should have said, hey, this guy's got, you know, there's red lights flashing everywhere. But since the system doesn't work, it didn't work in the case of Boston.
So this is a big emperor's clothes con, that you've got the president pretending that this is a front line in our national security, that the NSA have their finger in the dam, keeping the hordes at bay. Feinstein on the Intelligence Committee, she goes along with it. Everybody's going along with it. As I say, all they're talking about now are the old familiar arguments of civil liberties versus national security, but nobody's talking about the real issue here, which is how much the taxpayer is being ripped off in the name of national security. And I guess my question to you, Robert Baer, is if we have, as you said, this is feather bedding's been going on forever, why don't they at least do something useful with all the money that they steal? I mean, why don't they make something that works?
Because you can't make any money off hiring civil servants that know what they're doing. There's no money to be made off that. There's, you know, you've got federal employees, go out and find new people, hire them, they indoctrinate them in the system, they train them, they have a 30-year career. You don't make any money off that. You need this churn of software, churn of new equipment, churn of contracts. That is where the big skimming is done. I mean, with the civil service, there's no money to be made. It comes in contracts, and especially when it's secret, because no one can evaluate it on the outside. You say, well, where's the president in this? The president, this is the security industrial complex. If he took it on, that whole thing would come after him. I don't know what he thinks about all this, but it would come after him. There'd be generals popping up on Fox News. There'd be people popping up on CNN and the rest of it saying the president is undermining our security. And he's sitting on a tiger he can't get off of. And he knows it, because they'll start leaking on him. So he just, you know, what can you do? I mean, it's Congress, but to get elected to Congress, it costs $6 million a seat. And each time you get elected, every 2 years, you've got to raise that money from venture capitalists, from the Carlyle Group, from bundling, from law firms, and the rest of it. And it's a, you know, Congress is venture capital itself. It's a way to go make money in Washington. And Ian, I am here to tell you that since 9/11, there's been the biggest transfer of wealth in American history from public hands to private, thanks to this security nonsense.
So again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon, and he's the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers. So I'm just trying to get my head around the scope of this scandal, because the only people who ostensibly have oversight over this racket, because of the revolving door and because it's so entrenched at the highest level with people, you know, like the Carlyle Group owning Booz Allen, et cetera, and everything is so classified, nobody knows what the government's buying, and it doesn't matter if it doesn't work because they tell us it works, even if it doesn't, and they lie, as you pointed out, about Zazi being the only example they've come up with so far, and he was being run by the Brits at any rate. So what about the oversight people? I mean, if we're relying on the Congress, and after all, Michelle Bachmann was on the Intelligence Committee, so that doesn't give us much to hope for there. They're a part of the same food chain, aren't they? Because
the one time there was a whistleblower inside the NSA was a guy named Drake.
Right. I talked to him the other day, yeah.
Yeah, and the person at the Senate, a woman, as a result of this, got her house raided by the FBI with guns drawn. She'd retired, and they accused her of leaking warrantless wiretaps. Same way with Drake, guns drawn, come through the door. You know, if you're in the house and you're a lone staffer and you take this system on, someone's going to accuse you of leaking secrets or compromising American security, and they will come through your doors. This is just a fact. I mean, you know, whether Drake's right or wrong, I don't know, or the Senate staffer, that's what happened.
Well, Drake got off. They had to drop the case because it was...
Yeah, but his life is ruined.
Oh, I know. And Bradley Manning will...
He was talking about this carousel of stealing money, and that's what happened to him.
And Bradley Manning will spend the rest of his life in jail, and this guy, Snowden, will probably spend the rest of his life in jail, assuming that he's not escaped the clutches of either the Chinese or the CIA in Hong Kong. But again, I just wanted to get a sense, is it this completely corrupt that the only people that we rely on to have oversight over this scandalous, enormous transfer of wealth, this raid on the Treasury that's happened since 9/11, are the Congress, and they rely on the same food chain, do they not, in terms of campaign finance? I would hazard a guess that both the Carlyle Group and Booz Allen give a lot of money out, right, to congressmen and senators.
It's all bundled. You know, we don't know where it goes. A lawyer's a big law firm in D.C. sit down. They're instructed, all right, everybody give $10,000 to this one congressman for this election. This person's key. You know, it's an old story. That's not my specialty. It's an old story. But, yeah, you cannot talk about this. I mean, you cannot. You know, people were telling me that we're building this stuff, that iris recognition from 35 feet is great. You know, you can take a photograph and tell somebody's identity from taking a picture of their eye. Well, you know, they tried that on Tamerlan, Boston Bomber. It didn't work. And we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars was put into a program that didn't work.
And this goes on all the time.
Ian, you got to understand that I worked on a terrorism investigation where we used the same data after the event. This is very important. And it worked brilliantly, but it was all done with a FISA warrant, the equivalent of a FISA warrant in Lebanon, where you went in and you made the telephone companies give up their metadata. But it was targeting specific phones, not everybody in the country, and we already knew what had happened, of course.
Right.
But you don't need to take this software and try to read all communications in this country and the rest of the world, you know, at an enormous price and pretend it works. After 9/11, you figure out who did it. You ask for a FISA warrant for the 19 hijackers. All of these companies are more than happy to oblige. Doesn't matter. Cell phone companies, it's all done. But we're just adding this fake science in order to transfer wealth.
But I think it's also a part, is it not, of this belief that there is a technical fix to national security. It's like what the Star Wars was in the nuclear competition with the Russians. It was a technological fantasy that was going to suddenly change this impossibly dangerous nuclear arms race. And, of course, they're still wasting money on Star Wars as we speak. And it seems to be the same thing, that this is the promise that there's a technical fix to what ultimately can only be solved through human intelligence. And my sense is that the CIA, if they hired this high school dropout, he doesn't even have a high school diploma, and then he ends up working for tripling or quadrupling his salary at Booz Allen after serving as a IT analyst, I believe, at the CIA. What's happened to the CIA? I mean, I thought they used to recruit the smartest people.
No, they don't. It's dead. It's all contractors. The whole place is run by contractors. People just scream and yell about it. Contractors are running overseas CIA station and bases. They actually, contractors are doing it, not federal employees. They're sent out to these places. All right, you run this place for 6 months. Same way with Iraq was run by contractors. So was Afghanistan, and it's just a flow of these people, and there are contractors hiring contractors, and there's no control over it. And what they do is the CIA is putting all of its money. You look at the case in Moscow, where they had this recruitment letter. I mean, this stuff is called virtual recruitment. It's done off the internet. somebody had the bright idea is that you control the internet to find human sources. And the Russians showed us what happens with that when they got that guy arrested. So, no, it's
well, he was an embarrassment, though, wasn't he? I mean, that reinforces my argument.
He was a real person, but he got caught up in this trying to recruit people by over the internet.
Right, but his tradecraft was terrible, though. I mean, what I'm saying.
Well, they don't do tradecraft. No one knows what tradecraft is. They don't know how to work in Moscow. You can run circles around the Russians if you want.
Right.
If you've been doing it for years and gone through the training, but that guy clearly didn't. I mean, they've got ways to actually disguise it. You can't tell who people are. They're not cheap blonde wigs.
Right.
But people don't know how to do that anymore.
Well, that's the point, I think. It looks like all this money that's flowed in since 9/11 has completely corrupted our intelligence and devalued the professionalism, and it's just become a big boondoggle for all of these pigs with their snouts in the trough.
It's Nigeria on the Potomac.
Oh, my God. So it's that bad, right? All right. Well, I must say, I was looking for somebody to talk to because I felt that this was where the story really lies, and you've given me a hell of a lot more than I expected. So I'm going to have to scratch my head for a while and digest it all.
Ian, I'm just channeling what people tell me. I've been out of the CIA for a long time, and the people come out the door, they one way or another call me up, and all have similar complaints at whatever grade they retired at or left or unhappy or happy. They all say the same thing. It's not... No one comes out and says, look, if you only knew what was going on, you'd keep your mouth shut. And no one says that.
Everyone basically says that the taxpayer is getting screwed and that this contractor...
Everyone. And this is Special Forces as well, too.
Right.
I just had a long conversation with them. And they feel the same way.
Right. So what we thought about in terms of what Halliburton was to the Department of Defense, the Booz Allen people are to, and there's others as well, Lockheed Martin, for example, are to in intelligence. So you have a military-industrial complex, you have a terrorism-industrial complex, and you also have an intelligence-industrial complex, all stealing money at the same time.
Look, if you want to make money, don't go to Wall Street, go to Washington. Get a contract.
Well, Robert Baer, on that note, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with a program from August the 13th, 2013, about the American coup.
Revolving doors, what have I done? For someone on the TV, a tapping low. Revolving doors, what will I become? In the redneck sun. He paid up for a seven.
But they beg you, wait my name. I got one hell of a job, moving bond for the U.S. of A. Got the responsibility of our nation's top security. But every night and day, I salute the flag and say, thank you, Jesus, because I'm a secret agent, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Arkin, one of America's premier military experts, having served in Army intelligence in West Berlin during the Cold War. And since then, he's written more than a dozen books, worked as an advisor to the most influential non-governmental human rights and environmental organization, briefed hundreds of top military intelligence and government officials, and been part of countless exposés. Working for the Washington Post, he conceived and co-authored the landmark Top Secret America investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name with Dana Priest. His latest book is American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Arkin.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on again, Ian.
And you, of course, your earlier book with Dana Priest, Top Secret America, has very much been vindicated by all that's happened in what we could call the surveillance summer, prompted by Edward Snowden. Do you think that, obviously your new book comes out on the day before 9/11, but how much have we caught up with your old book?
Well, you know, when we started our work on trying to investigate the growth of secret government since 9/11 back in 2008, one of the things that we really quickly came to the conclusion of was that the size and the scope and the growth was so enormous that even those who were on the inside couldn't fathom it and really couldn't understand it, and that's really what's been vindicated in the Snowden revelations and in all of the discussion about NSA surveillance over the past few months. And I think that, you know, the thing that still intrigues me as an American citizen and as an American is where does it come from and what's the result? And those are two very difficult questions. And in the book American Coup, what I try to do is begin to answer those questions by looking at sort of this dual system of government that we have, the one in which, on the one hand, we can be told that no one is being surveilled and that everything that's being done is legal, and that the government is, carefully monitoring and carefully vetting everything that it does, and that no one should be fearful. And on the other hand, we know that all of these things are going on, and for the first time in a long time, in my career at least, I'm even hearing from people on the inside saying enough is enough, too much is going on. And so there's this dual system that's going on parallel with this open system, and that's precisely what I describe in American Coup, which is my attempt to try to get to the bottom of understanding why this perpetual system exists and how it survives.
And William Arkin, you say that you're not describing a military coup with a general standing at a podium, flag behind him, declaring the deposing of elected leaders and an institution of martial law, but rather a wholly American coup in which a desk-bound takeover of the highest reach of the government by a coterie of gray men of the national security establishment has taken place by what you call executive agents. So,
well basically what we have, Ian, and really what Edward Snowden revealed, even if the substance of what he necessarily revealed isn't that new, but what he revealed was this whole alternative universe, of names and programs and paper that goes back and forth amongst a group of people who exist in an alternative universe. And no one is supposed to penetrate that universe. And now we see, as a result of this, that even overseas, in places like Brazil and Germany, where, you know, the United States is backpedaling and saying, of course, we don't spy on our friends, et cetera, is that there's like a public stance, and then there is the actual world. And that actual world, I say, is run by this set of what I call executive agents, people who are the leadership of the national security establishment, who basically operate on their own, who basically operate under a set of secret rules, many of which are contrary to our laws and to the Constitution. But they do so not in some conspiracy or even as a partisan matter. They do so with the exact express permission of Obama and with the exact express permission of Bush. And they did previously even with Clinton. The reality is that just the technologies have gotten better and better, all justified by what they consider to be a level of threat that necessitates the rule breaking in order to create the security. And unfortunately, that's what the president sort of told us the other day in his own speech. You know, you can have absolute security, or you can have civil rights and civil liberties, but you can't have both. And that's an unfortunate paradigm that now has reached the highest levels within the U.S. government, but it isn't necessarily the truth. It isn't necessarily the country that we want to live in. It isn't necessarily what the framers of the Constitution had in mind. And so the executive agents aren't some renegade group. That's what's evolved in our country. They're people who believe strongly that they, in fact, are caring for the national security, and their existence and their leeway is granted by Congress and granted by the executive branch, tolerated seemingly by the American people, all on the basis of fallacious presentations of the nature of the terrorist threat and the need for this kind of comprehensive surveillance state in order to collect the amount of information that is actually needed to surveil our enemies.
And again, I'm speaking with William Arkin, one of America's premier military experts, having served in Army intelligence in West Berlin during the Cold War. Since then, he's written more than a dozen books and has been part of countless exposés. Working for the Washington Post, he conceived and co-authored the landmark Top Secret America investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name with Dana Priest. His latest book is American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution. And you mentioned the Founding Fathers obliquely a minute ago, Bill Arkin, and of course we all remember the adage of Ben Franklin's, which was that he who would trade liberty for temporary security deserves neither. But this evolution that you're talking about of the takeover by these gray men, these executive agents, has been long in coming, starting, it's actually gone from Harry Truman all the way to Barack Obama.
Well, it is true, Ian, and what we have seen is an evolution of the nature of the threat and the nature of the technology. Government hasn't particularly changed, but the reality is that during the nuclear age, when there was a more or less bipartisan consensus about the nature of the threat, a group of executive agents under something called the program, and I'm not kidding, it's actually called the program, were charged with survival of the nation and were given the authorities in order to ensure that if Washington were destroyed and the government would destroy, that someone would survive. That program persisted all throughout our history, even if it had ups and downs in various civil defense programs and eras, and obviously reached an apogee again during the Reagan administration, and ironically reached one of its lowest points in the first Bush administration when Dick Cheney himself was responsible for closing down many of the Cold War programs. But when 9/11 came along, this was the same group of people and the same thinking that led to this phenomenal shift to the counterterrorism intelligence complex that now exists, that really controls an enormous amount of money and an enormous amount of talent and an enormous amount of the government in terms of what is perceived, again, as necessary in order to preserve the nation. And so the weapons of mass destruction piece of the program and of the executive agents who administer this nation in this sort of secret realm is very consistent because, of course, after 9/11, the one thing that the Bush administration said that sort of justified everything was weapons of mass destruction. It justified, you know, all of the actions that were taken that were have subsequently been deemed to have been illegal or immoral or unethical because, my God, the terrorists might acquire a weapon of mass destruction. And that aesthetic continues to this day, but now it's almost as if we're in a post-enemy world, which is to say that even though Saddam Hussein has been deposed and Iraq has been denuclearized, even though Osama bin Laden is dead, even though by any objective measurement the threat of terrorism has declined significantly from where it was in 2001, this machine continues to operate as if the threats are greater and greater every year because we don't seem to be capable of either penetrating it or turning off the spigot of money that would, in fact, force them to make some actual decisions about priorities and about what they are actually achieving in all of that collection of information that they're involved in.
But William Markin, how did proportionality get lost? If indeed we've made this transition, as you just pointed out, from the Cold War nuclear age, where within 20 minutes we would be destroyed, and then 20 minutes later the Soviets would be destroyed, and for 30 years all of our major cities were targeted for instant vaporization. And I recall Rumsfeld and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs during the time of the Bush II presidency often talked about al-Qaeda being the greatest threat we faced. Well, let's face it, that if one of those Russian nuclear missiles had gotten through to an American city, it would have caused damage and death thousands of times greater than what happened on 9/11. And Russia was a real enemy, and we were literally, we could have all been wiped out. The entire globe could have been destroyed or diminished to an unlivable state. And yet, here we are chasing a few hundred losers in caves as though that is more dangerous than what we lived through and, by the way, rather miraculously survived.
Well, you know, of course, this is a problem that the American people have created for themselves as much as anything. I mean, George Bush, as president, spoke at the West Point graduation in 2002, just a few months after 9/11, and stood up in front of all of those young graduates who were about to go into the Army and said that the threat of terrorism was greater than the threat that the United States had ever faced in Nazi Germany or in against the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And the newspapers and the editorials reported it as if that were fact. And so we ourselves have tolerated this kind of slippery slope towards the world of the infinite threat, and that's where we are right now. And that's one part of it, is our own sort of laziness and sloppiness about governing our own country and keeping our own government accountable. Another part of it, Ian, however, is that what we have also transitioned from is an industrial age to an information age. And in an industrial age, even though you can speak about nuclear weapons and you can describe them in their physical form and you can even make calculations as to how many people would die and how many of us have not seen those rings around New York or various places that show the exact radius of the blast and radiation of a nuclear weapon. But in the world of information, it becomes far more ephemeral. What are the threats? What are the defenses? How are we all interconnected? What types of militaries are we going to require in order to defend ourselves? And as the hijackers themselves demonstrated on 9/11, a lot of damage can be done with household objects, if you will. And so I think this proportionality or this idea somehow that we live in a physical realm in which we can kind of calculate at least how much is needed for our defense and we can then therefore debate how much is needed for our defense, we've transitioned to this more infinite realm in which we really, no one is making a calculation because there is no calculation to be made and no one is willing to say, let's shut down this program or let's ramp back this effort in national security because no one wants to be the one that's going to be blamed if there's another terrorist attack. So there doesn't seem to be much leadership. There certainly isn't any from the White House. I think that the speech that President Obama gave in justification of the surveillance programs and also his counter to those who would criticize it was not only disappointing, but disingenuous in many ways, in the sense of we're going to have a review group and we're going to have a commission and we're going to have this and we're going to have that and we're going to make everything legal. Well, it means essentially that the technical programs themselves will be reviewed and revised, and we'll have to write a few more checks in order to make sure that everything is done in the way in which the consensus in Washington says it needs to be done. But the soul of what's happening isn't going to change one iota, and in 6 years of the Obama administration, I think it should be clear to everybody in America that he doesn't have any intention of changing national security, and that, in fact, whoever is the next president is going to have to contend with the same machine, the same program, the same executive agents, the same set of two rules, what I call the ABCs and the XYZs of the Constitution, that's a permanent artifact of America that we're all now going to have to struggle to gain control of and get rid of.
And the ABCs are the public laws guided by the constitutions, and the XYZs function beneath and between the lines, the charter of another realm, as you call it. Well, William Arkin, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I really appreciate the time you've given us and the extraordinary insight, and most of all, your new book, American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution.
Ian, it's a pleasure to talk to you again, and hope to see you next time I'm in L.A.
Me too. Again, I've been speaking with William Arkin, one of America's premier military experts, having served in Army intelligence in West Berlin during the Cold War. And since then, he's written more than a dozen books, worked as an advisor to the most influential non-government human rights and environmental organizations, briefed hundreds of top military intelligence and government officials, and has been a part of countless exposés. Working for The Washington Post, he conceived and co-authored the landmark Top Secret America investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name with Dana Priest. His latest book is American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with the program from December the 9th of 2013 about an open letter from the tech giants asking the President and the Congress to curb NSA spying.
I'm at home in the streets of Rome, or just hanging around on Shanghai. Danger is my logo, espionage and go-go, I'm just digging this American crime. I gave on the slip.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Rotenberg, who's the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emergency privacy and civil liberties issues. He has served on several national and international advisory panels, including the expert panels on cryptography policy and computer security for the OECD, the legal experts on cyberspace law for UNESCO, and he chairs the ABA Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Rotenberg.
Nice speaking with you.
And Mark, what did you make of this full-page letter that appeared in both the New York Times and the Washington Post? It has a website attached to it. It comes from AOL, Apple, Facebook, Google, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Twitter, and Yahoo, issuing an open letter to both the President and the Congress, urging them to make reforms in NSA surveillance and generally increase transparency and independent oversight. What do you make of it?
Well, I think it's a step in the right direction. Clearly, there's a need to strengthen privacy laws in the United States. We've all been reading the almost weekly reports from Mr. Snowden about the true extent of surveillance by the National Security Agency. There have been hearings in Washington, and I think an important debate broadly about how we recapture some of the privacy that was lost in response to 9/11 when so many of these new surveillance systems were put in place. So as a general matter, I think the Internet companies are right to say we need to strengthen privacy laws. But, of course, you do need to look into the details now and ask the question, what exactly is it that the companies are backing and what is it that we really need? And my view is that there's still a long way to go to establish the kinds of privacy protections that should be established. The Internet companies, I think, have a pretty modest agenda, one that doesn't really address the core concerns that most Internet users have.
Well, there's reports so far indicate, though, that these Internet companies, and particularly the telco companies like AT&T and Verizon, get paid to cooperate with the NSA to basically get their metadata. But it seems like the NSA maybe went too far, as far as these companies are concerned, by tapping into their clouds. Is that what pushed them over the edge?
Well, I think particularly for the Internet firms, and most notably Google, Yahoo, and then Microsoft, the realization that the government was collecting data from them not only through the channels that had been established between the companies and the government, but also truly backdoor by going directly to servers and going directly to network communications, probably did lead the companies to conclude that they had a very serious problem. They needed to work together to establish stronger privacy safeguards. Now, I will say, again, from the user perspective, we have been urging these companies for many years to put in place better technologies for privacy, to routinely encrypt communications, to encrypt stored data, to minimize data collection where possible, to delete personal data where possible. And for the most part, they didn't show very much interest in all of that, not until they realized that it was their own servers and their own networks that were under attack. So they're a little late to the party, I would say. We welcome them, but there's a lot more that needs to happen to address these key concerns.
So isn't there blowback across both the economic and political landscape around the world? We certainly know about the political blowback from Snowden's revelations. I believe only 1% of which have been made public so far. If that's 1%, God knows what the 99% is going to do. But my understanding is that there is a real blowback in terms of foreign companies wondering about doing business in the United States. The reason the Germans were so upset about the NSA revelations, they didn't care whether the NSA were finding out what Angela Merkel ordered on her sandwiches. They were really upset that they were tapping into trade negotiations, etc. So is this having a detrimental effect on American business or on foreign businesses doing business with America?
Well, I think that's the subtext, in fact, of the letter that the Internet firms sent to the President and to members of Congress. They were calling for new forms of transparency and accountability and some limitations on NSA access to customer data. But they were also communicating the very strong concern that a lot of business, particularly in the cloud-based computing model, which is essentially remote services, large businesses and universities that used to keep their data in-house are now being encouraged to move it to providers who keep it off-site and process the data that way. It's that cloud-based model that's so critical to the future of the Internet and the growth of many firms that's now come under close scrutiny by foreign businesses and foreign governments because they're saying, you know, if we put this data online with these U.S. firms, the NSA is going to get access to all that, and we have real concerns. So I think the letter was saying, given that pressure that the companies are now facing from potential customers overseas to do a better job on privacy, that it is very much an economic issue, and that's in part why they want to see the privacy law strengthened.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Rotenberg, the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emergency privacy and civil liberty issues. He has served on several national and international advisory panels, including the expert panels on cryptography policy and computer security for the OECD, the legal experts on cyberspace law for UNESCO, and he chairs the ABA Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. And beyond the concerns about the clouds, because I think people thought that the stuff was encrypted on the way in, but they didn't realize that the NSA were tapping into the clouds themselves, right?
Well, that's right. And as I said earlier, I think that's what got the internet firms particularly upset, because they realized that the arrangements that they believe they had in place with the government to establish certain practices for transferring data just weren't being respected. In other words, the NSA had found ways to gain access to the communications between Google servers and were collecting user data in that way. But again, you know, many of the privacy organizations that have been pushing for many years to strengthen the protections for users had warned the companies that they weren't doing enough to safeguard privacy. And I think we're also perplexed that in many of the debates over updating privacy laws, both in the U.S. and in Europe, many of these same companies were oftentimes on the opposite side of the debate. They would say, we don't need new legislation. Self-regulation is doing fine. If people don't like what one business is doing, they can go to another business. So they spend quite a bit of time trying to reassure policymakers in Washington that there was no need to update legislation. Of course, now that they find that their own data is vulnerable to collection by the government, they've changed their position. So we're glad, of course, that they understand how very important it is to update these privacy laws, but I think it's also important to understand that ultimately it's the user's data that's at issue. It's not just the data that the companies manage. It's the personal information that's provided by the user.
But that's where there's a certain amount of ambiguity, isn't it? Because these companies like Facebook and Yahoo mine your personal information. That's how they make money. So this is a bit like the pot calling the kettle black, isn't it?
Well, it certainly creates a dilemma in the sense that on the one hand, they want protections from government access and use of the data they gather. On the other hand, they don't want any restrictions as to how they use the data that they've obtained from the users. And our view is that because it is ultimately the user's data, that we need privacy laws that both protect the companies against improper access by government, and we favor that. But we also need some limitations on the collection and use of the data that the companies are gathering, because users don't have a meaningful way to limit the use of that data once the companies acquire it. And not surprisingly, people are becoming increasingly frustrated, you know, about the loss of privacy. They're being told routinely that you really can't expect privacy anymore when you go on the internet. But of course, in many ways, that doesn't make any sense at all, because people have no understanding of what information is being collected or how it's being used. So for all these reasons, we think a comprehensive privacy law that incorporates some of the elements that the internet companies have recommended, as well as some elements that others have proposed, is the best way to go.
So my reading of this open letter in Monday's New York Times and Washington Post, and there's a website that goes along with it, and this is a letter from AOL, Apple, Facebook, Google, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Twitter, and Yahoo to both the President and the Congress to rein in the NSA. There aren't really any specifics here, are they? It feels kind of like a wish list. Where's the expression?
Well, they have five specific proposals. I think they are somewhat vague, but they're still be understood in Washington as specific recommendations with regard to the transparency and the accountability of government access to the information that the companies maintain. And I think on those points, the privacy groups will probably agree that that makes some sense, because it will make it more difficult for the government to get access to sensitive personal information. On a couple of the other points, I think there may be less agreement. For example, the internet companies are very concerned about regional clouds, which Europe is talking about, Asian countries, South American countries are talking about. They do see that as a potential loss of business. Our view is that it depends entirely on whether or not the jurisdiction where the service is being provided offers sufficient privacy protection. And if it doesn't, and another jurisdiction says privacy protection is important to us and we're going to enforce it, then we think regional clouds would be good. And as for their last point, I believe that they're recommending some unified approach to processing the requests they receive from multiple governments. That may or may not be good for user privacy. We've pushed for a comprehensive privacy framework, which begins by saying that if the government is going to collect information about users anywhere in the world, there should be a clear legal standard to protect the users, which is, again, a different emphasis. It's more about protecting the user interests than trying to accommodate the firms.
But what about the companies that actually make the technology for these new platforms like these clouds? Apparently, Amazon has taken the lead in this, and I believe now Google is trying to catch up. Is there any concern about at the manufacturing level?
Well, the cloud technology is really a storage technique, mm-hmm. and the primary concern does have to do with the access by the National Security Agency to the private information. It can be user data, it can be proprietary business information that's being stored by the cloud service provider. And to be fair, I mean, there are enormous economies in cloud-based services and some innovation that probably wouldn't be possible in the traditional localized model for providing computing. But as attractive as those features may be, there is still the consideration that if the information that's being stored by Amazon or by Cisco or by some other firm is routinely accessible to the U.S. National Security Agency, then many companies, particularly outside of the United States, are going to be less likely to use those services.
And that's the problem, isn't it? That's what's affecting U.S. business, is the notion that they're either in complicity or vulnerable to the NSA.
Well, that's exactly the problem. And unless the companies are able to establish more clearly that they do have strong privacy standards in place that are backed up by law, they will likely lose business. I mean, that process is already underway with many companies in the United States citing concerns about the NSA surveillance as leading to a reduction in market share. Again, our view is that if more had been done earlier to strengthen privacy laws, this would be less of a problem today. But it is a problem today in part because of the dramatic expansion of the surveillance capabilities of the NSA post 9/11. It's also a problem because there's been enormous reluctance in Washington to update U.S. privacy laws. So I think to some extent, not completely, of course, but I think the Internet firms could have done more sooner to show support for privacy protection.
But I guess in closing, I suppose better late than never, right?
Well, yes. And as I said, I mean, we welcome them to the party. It's a little late, but there's a lot still to do. And if we can take a broad approach to the protection of privacy, including both elements that they have set out in their letter, as well as many other goals that users would support, I think we will end up with better privacy safeguards.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Mark Rotenberg.
Nice speaking with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Rotenberg, as the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emergency privacy and civil liberty issues. He has served on several national and international advisory panels, including the expert panels on cryptography policy and computer security for the OECD and legal experts on cyberspace law for UNESCO, and he chairs the ABA Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. This has been a retrospective of Background Briefing from 2013. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.